You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome back to His Darker Materials. This is the podcast that goes episode by episode through the HBO BBC show His Dark Materials, based on the novels by Philip Pullman. And today we are going to be talking about season 3, episode 6 of the show. So if you have not seen everything up to season 3, episode 6, please go away, watch them. They're really pretty good. And come back to us and enjoy it at that point, because we will be spoiling everything up to this point. I'm Helen O'Hara. With me, as always, is Dave Corkery.
Hello, Helen.
Hello. And we will be joined by, as ever, some of the cast and crew to talk us through how they made the show. But to begin with, let's have a quick kind of overview of what you thought of episode 6. Dave, this was mahoosive, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, it's a big episode, right? And we're and we're still like, this is like, we're three from the end here.
Anti-penultimate.
And, right? They are just packing it in. I mean, like, this is the longest amount of notes we've had to write. Just so if I'm to judge it on a pure note level. Yeah, I thought it was excellent. But what I liked is there's a lot of real big plot stuff and expositional stuff, but the episode also made room for some really great character stuff. And I think that's what I really admire about this show, in that I think a lesser fantasy show would just get caught up in the lore and the destinies and the prophecies and all that. But we get time here for just Mrs. Coulter talking to her demon in a very intimate fashion. And for me, that was one of the most memorable scenes in this whole series.
Yeah, it really is. Mrs. Coulter, what a freaking character. I mean, on the page of the book as well as here on screen. But, you know, with Ruth Wilson and this whole team, I think they've just knocked it out of the park with her. She is so complicated, so hard to pin down, but not in a way that feels like they're making up as they went along, not in a way that feels forced or artificial. It just feels like she really is this weird and unusual and powerful and terrifying and loving and crazy a person. You know, it just feels like she has all those layers and she just kind of comes fully formed. Should we start with her? Because, you know, we pretty much finished with her last week. So she seemed to have escaped from the Magisterium's clutches just as they were about to sever her demon. She seemed to be in control, and then literal heaven intervened and, you know, knocked everything a little bit for six.
Yeah. And so she's left in the aftermath of this. And we are looking at a Magisterium with, you know, that's kind of been shook the powers out. You know, she goes to find Fra Pavel to ask, what did Lyra survive this? And he tells her, it's the quickest alethiometer reading Fra Pavel has ever done.
Ever. Yeah. He's Lyra speed at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, fair play. He works well under pressure, I guess, by candlelight. But he tells her that she is dead, right? Or we don't, I forget exactly what words he used, but we know she's in the land of the dead. But so he's not wrong. She takes off to, hops back in the intention craft, and then is back to Azrael to blame him, really, essentially. And fairly so, I think, in a way.
If you were a bit confused about what happened at the end of last episode, this kind of makes it clear, I feel like, because she literally says, yes, I had disarmed the bomb, everything was fine, and then you poked the wrong bear, and they sent a lightning bolt, which made the bomb go off anyway, essentially, right?
And I think we needed that.
We were both a bit confused by it. So this is good. She has made that clear. I think what's also really just fun is that, you know, she doesn't always have all the right answers because she doesn't always have all the information. Yes, Lyra is among the dead, you know, as this episode begins. What she doesn't know is that Lyra was already among the dead before the bomb went off, and Lyra isn't technically dead. She's just among, you know, so it's kind of, I quite enjoy when people are making decisions based on faulty evidence in some of these kind of stories.
Yeah.
Because it allows for a lot of dramatic irony. But yeah, I mean, her scenes with Azrael, who's still being it has to be said, a total dick about his daughter.
He's so awful, isn't
he? He's so awful in this.
Yeah. And I think particularly in this episode, you know, she says, you know, he's like still trying to fix something. And he also says something like, you know, he says some awful stuff here. He's like, I'm sorry for your loss. Like he won't acknowledge that he has anything to do with Lyra, claim any responsibility. We see that kind of come to a head a bit with Ogunwe, I think, who is seeing the real Azrael here, because he's seeing how he reacts to his daughter's deaths, allegedly, and to Ruta's death. The main emotion we see from him in this episode is excitement, right? There's no mourning. There's no hint of mourning. Whereas Mrs. Coulter, I thought, again, Ruth Wilson, just so good, because she's playing, we see a different Mrs. Coulter in every episode, right? But yet it always feels like the same person. She's holding herself differently here. She's slumped. She's just browbeaten. There's glimpses of a smile coming through occasionally, but she is, or an occasional sort of trying to work her previous magic, but mostly this is a defeated woman.
I think you see that best in, well, first of all, like her demon, she and her demon are back on the outs a little bit. Mm. And her demon not, you know, coming with her when sort of told to do so. Oh,
such a good moment.
So good. But then also it's the showdown with Serafina Pecola, who comes back and is like, you know, you murdered my friends. I'm not having this. You are, you know, I'll kill you too. And she's like, yeah, brilliant. Super good. Put me out of my misery. You know, it's a real kind of a nihilism, I think, that she's feeling right now. Just a complete, just annihilated by grief, I think, at this point.
And I think this is a full realization in that scene with Serafina Pecola of this idea of how Mrs. Coulter has changed, you know, with what we've been talking about for the past few episodes. But she says it in, as you know, in the dialogue, essentially, that she is, you know, love made her fragile, and that she allowed that in and it changed her. And I think the other interesting thing from that scene was that whole idea of recontextualizing the Adam and Eve mythology. You know, Serafina talks about Eve, you know, all Eve did was dare to experience, you know, and she flips it on its head. This temptation, like Eve is always portrayed as the villain, as dangerous, or in a way, or she, you know, weak, but she flips it and says it's brave, right? It's bravery. And that's one of the defining characteristics of Lyra.
Very, very much so. Yeah. And that's a really good point. I think, you know, well, look, there are whole dissertations that have been written about, you know, Eve mythology and how it's basically changed over time and how it is used to justify a huge amount of sexism and misogyny and just victimization, basically, of women. And I think that, you know, the witches, if they stand for one single thing, and of course they stand for many, but if there's one single thing, it's absolutely not accepting that reading of history, that reading of life. So it makes perfect sense that Serafina would be the one for that to come out now in conversation with her, for this to be the conversation. And because I think she recognizes on some level that Mrs. Coulter's own witchiness. No, she's obviously been through a trauma. She's been through a process much like the witches go through when they become witches, you know. So there is an element, I think, of sisterhood here, and there is an element of seeing her maybe even subconsciously as someone similar to herself. Do you know what I mean? I feel like there's something of that there.
I agree. There was a compassion and an empathy from Serafina here when Mrs. Coulter wanted the opposite, you know?
Exactly. And I think that was beautifully played by both actresses. And especially, you know, given everything that Serafina has lost along the way, and given that things don't go super well for the witches this episode either.
No, I guess we'll just briefly mention, I guess, so Ruta's demon gets sucked into this void, right, that Azrael discovers. And so we get some opening dialogue exposition in this episode from Metatron about, you know, dust can be taken away, and that dust was given to man as, you know, as free will, right? That's essentially what enabled it, I think, is what he's saying, right? And so it's been taken away, and we've seen this, and I like, we see this throughout all the plots. Everyone, this again feels like a convergence of the plots here, where everyone is experiencing this great chasm and dust being sucked in. It feels like suitably kind of epic. And yeah, Ruta sadly gets sucked into it, or her demon does. Yeah.
Her demon does, yeah. It's very lucky that she's the only one. I mean, obviously it's not lucky for her, but it's very lucky for other people, because we see, you know, the first time we see Azrael, first of all, he is delighted that this has happened. He is over the moon that he has provoked somebody enough that they have torn up the world, the multiverse, in reaction.
He's mad, isn't he? There's a madness to him.
Yeah. But also, he goes spelunking in the rift.
Yeah.
And like, his demon is there at the top going, this is a super bad idea. Yeah. And literally, yeah, the more she tells him it's reckless, the deeper he goes into it. So she says it's reckless. So his reaction is to go deeper. Now, again, if she is him, if she is his soul, and his reaction to being told by his soul is, this is a bad idea, is to do it more. That tells you so much about him.
It does. But that's such an interesting idea. This whole, again, you know, back to this whole conversation with yourself, right? But I think people, we experience that as well. Not me personally, but I mean, there's a certain element of having to overcome your instincts or your sort of logic sometimes, or part of you that's telling you not to do something to be able to do something. There's a sort of that. There's something about a bravery in that almost. Not that I don't think what he's doing is bravery. I think it's just madness and folly. Mostly.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's him just completely lost in his own plans and his own concerns and not really admitting any naysayers at this point.
And like you said, it's an excitement as well, right? He's excited to go down there, and it's the scientist in him and the discovery. Now that he's on the brink of success and he's sort of, you know, stirred the beast, he's becoming more and more reckless as well. I think, again, I think Ogunwe, we see, you know, he's starting to realize what he has signed up for, and he kind of calls Azrael on it. And I think the other thing, and then the other big moment that Azrael has in this episode is the confrontation with Yorick, which was a good scene.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, so it's important, obviously, from a story point of view and for a update point of view. You know, Yorick's able to tell him, no, it's not. You know, Lyra isn't dead. She's just in the land of the dead. Totally different thing. I can understand your confusion, but seriously. You know, but also, like, Yorick, I think, finally convincing Azrael that, you know, he's maybe been missing a couple of things. So this whole, she is everything you are not
thing. Oh, I like that line. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely great. And then, oh, perhaps I should have known her better. He's like, oh, okay, maybe you may make a point. And it's that classic kind of, there's a certain kind of alpha male who will take a woman seriously if another alpha male tells them to.
Oh, God, that's a great point.
I feel like it's that. Like, Mrs. Coulter could stand there all day going, Lyra matters. And he's like, yeah, yeah, okay, whatever.
And it's only when a giant cool bear says it.
A giant
like,
cool bear
maybe
says
maybe there is something, you know? About... No, you're right, because he instantly becomes proud of her, and doesn't he? He's like, my daughter is staging a prison break. I'm so proud. And he calls her his daughter, right? Which he very rarely does.
It's that is not his go-to.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, yeah. So he is Azrael kind of misogynistic deep down then?
I mean, look, I'm not saying like deliberately misogynistic. I think he's closer to being just misanthropic and just not caring about anybody, you know, but at the same time, I think there is an element of, you know, those guys. I mean, alpha male is a stupid term, and it like in no way relates to wolves, and all, it's all based on nonsense. But you know what I mean when I say it. But I think there is a tendency in guys who think they're the guy to only listen to other guys who feel the same way. And even then, you know, rather warily, only after sizing them up and deciding that they're really okay. Yeah, to me, it makes a certain amount of sense that he would listen to Yorick more than anybody else. Or like Ogunwe has become, you know, a major advisor in the same way. I mean, he shows a certain amount of deference and respect to the witches, but they feel like a slightly different attitude to the one he has with Ogunwe and the one he has with Yorick.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, there's an inherent sort of difference there. I like that he's finally paying attention to Lyra now. But I also think that another reason might be that, is it Mrs. Coulter who points out to him that she has achieved more than his rebellion ever could, or one of the characters, yes. Perhaps Seraphina says that. And I think that's him finally having to acknowledge that not only is she important, but she is suddenly his ego and is under threat, right? Because it's like he's, and I think that kind of makes him a little bit proud because he's claiming the victory then, because that's my daughter.
So that counts right. As me doing it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a bit of that as well. But I think there's also, you know, he's been showing all season when people have mentioned Lyra, told him Lyra matters, he's been, I think he's partly been dismissing it for just that reason. It's like, no, but okay, whatever about Lyra. I have been working on this my entire life. I have literally broken a door between worlds. I've gone out and recruited angels to my cause, traveled the multiverse, picking up soldiers. And you want to tell me that's all less important than some pre-teenage girl who just went looking for her buddy? Come on, like, let's be serious, people. You know, there's been an element of just instinctive dismissal, and because of what Lyra is rather than what Lyra's character is. And so, yeah, he's beginning to reckon with that now.
There's almost a bit of a meta commentary on it in terms of, like, he represents kind of a very traditional archetypal hero, right, in many ways. And I think in a lesser story.
And oh, he'd be the hero.
He'd be our hero, right? Yeah. Whereas, so he's also quite threatened by this sort of young adult character protagonist, who is the protagonist.
Who is the actual... Yeah. I mean, honestly, you could also make it into a sort of meta commentary on... you know, on these books, on young adult publishing, on you know, teen-focused anything. There is a tendency to dismiss anything that teen girls like as inherently unserious and unimportant.
Silly.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, look at how the Beatles were seen towards the end of their career versus the beginning. You know, if teen girls like you, that is inherently suspicious to some people, and it inherently means you are unserious. And so... for Asriel to be dismissive in the same way, I feel like it could be a meta commentary on the whole of young adult publishing. Perhaps I'm reading a little bit too much into it, but like, it's
really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, because also I think the same could be said of Robert Pattinson recently, right?
100%. You know? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, he's Batman now. He's cool.
It's like, yeah, people have been telling you he was quite good for years. Like, if he can, do you know what I mean? And joining us today is Francesca Gardner, who is one of the screenwriters on the show, one of the three screenwriters, and an executive producer as well. So Francesca wrote episodes 6, 7, and 8. She had to bring it all home here at the end of season 3 and has some fascinating stuff to say about all 3 episodes. So as ever, there are going to be some spoilers here. You'll be glad to know we haven't talked, you know, about anything to come in any of her other shows. She also writes for Succession, for example. So no Succession spoilers, but there are His Dark Material spoilers for episodes 6, 7, and 8 in here. So if you're a spoiler averse, please do go away and come back once you've seen them. But otherwise, here's a really fascinating talk from Francesca Gardner. So Francesca, what was it like sort of adapting the most complicated book in this series?
I mean, it was a huge challenge. It was daunting. For many reasons, the first being the scale, and the second being that I'm such an avid and rabid, maybe, fan of the books that I felt a huge sense of trepidation about getting it right and doing it justice. I think the main challenge is that The Amber Spyglass is so metaphorical. You know, the story becomes much more like a parable, more so than the previous two books, I think. And television is such a literal medium. You know, how do you translate those metaphors to the screen without it seeming completely ridiculous? How do you dramatize a war against heaven? What does it look like to have angels fighting each other? You know, the storytelling this season needs to have epic scale. And that's hard. That's hard, and particularly with financial constraints. This book has got... particularly, I think, this beautiful, subtle exploration of themes around love and death and faith. So the task in writing is keeping a balance in the script between those epic, spectacular moments and where we focus in on the smaller, more intimate character scenes. And the production is huge, with many, many smart and strong voices and points of view to juggle. So it was a challenge on every front, but a worthy one, a juicy one.
Yeah. So how do you writers like decide? Do you take an episode each? Do you take a story strand each? Do you basically pass everything back and forth among yourselves? You know, how do you work as a team?
Interesting. It's very different from how we work on Succession. His Dark Materials, we don't have a writer's room. We don't really have a lot of interface with each other. It was very clear that Jack was going to be, was writing the first half of the season. I was writing the back end of the season. And then Amelia was writing the sort of keystone hinging episode, episode five. And we didn't really have a lot of conversation around that. It was, I mean, I think that we are very complementary in terms of our interpretations of the story. And sometimes we have to kind of check in. Mostly it's the script team, the script editors in the production, who are checking that the, you know, the neck connects to the shoulders, connects to the torso, that the storyline is being worked through that way. But yeah, with Succession, on the other hand, you know, we're in a writer's room, we're untangling and plotting together. It's a different beast, this one.
I guess it's working different muscles, isn't it? It's sort of giving you a chance to try different things.
It is, but also what we've got with the books, which we have, this is an adaptation. So we have such strong pointers and guidelines and, you know, about what it is that we're doing. We've got this beautiful text to work with.
I mean, do you remember when you first read it? Is this something that's been in your life for a long time? Or, you know, did you come to it when this came up as an option, as a job?
Oh no, I'm afraid that I read the Northern Lights when it came out when I was 11.
Oh, amazing.
So I'm fully like fangirl territory. I remember The Subtle Knife coming out. I remember The Amber Spyglass coming out. And I remember begging I would force these books on anyone who would listen. And I remember my dad being quite snooty about the fact that they were YA. And then I bought him the trilogy for Christmas and he loved them, absolutely loved them. And, you know, I think that the thing that I really responded to in Philip's writing is that he never patronizes children. It's an epic exploration of the darker themes, that you wouldn't necessarily normally find in children's literature, or you would, but there's a sort of Disney sanitizing thing that's happened, I think, with children's storytelling. If you look back to the Grimm's fairy tales, that's much more like the sort of light and darkness that we see in Philip's writing.
Absolutely. Even more grim, frankly, at times, I think, than anything here.
Well, I don't know. The severing from a demon is,
yep, fair. You know,
basically the sort of that violent act to a child is very dark, I think.
It is. Absolutely. So, like, just to be clear, this will come with a spoiler warning and it will be marked as such. But, you know, that back end of the season, you have a huge amount to deal with. It feels like quite a few of the biggest challenges from the book do come in that section, because you have, as you talked about, the war with heaven, you have, you know, those incredibly complicated characters of Mrs. Coulter and Lord Asriel to deal with. You have, you know, the job of transforming, or maybe continuing to transform would be more accurate, you know, Will and Lyra's relationship from a friendship and a sort of almost orphans huddling together on a raft into a sort of romance. So you had some big challenges to unpack. Was there anything that particularly gave you pause?
Oh, I mean, yes. Every it felt like there was a Sophie's choice every week, you know, about what I was able to portray, what to prioritize. We're all so keen to do justice to the complexity of the stories, and you know, these worlds where you have a demon, you have an animal representation of your soul. You know, you want as much that's such a gift for storytelling, but it's such a nightmare for a production budget, because every time that you have a demon in a scene, you're costing the production just the most extraordinary amounts of money. And my episodes, the last three episodes, 6, 7, 8, they were by far the most expensive, and so I felt that I was just burning through the cash there with every single scene, but it was necessary because these are the crucial moments from the book, you know, from the epic to the most gorgeous, quiet love moments between Will and Lyra. One of the things that I struggled with, but I'm really pleased, I think we have achieved it, is staying true to the sort of pattern of weaving of storytelling through the story and the importance of of storytelling as an act of empowerment. One of my favorite ever scenes in the book I got to adapt, which was when Mary Malone, playing the serpent, effectively telling Will and Lyra about her own experience of falling in love. And it needed to be really quiet and really simple and really true to the book. And sometimes I think there's a nervousness in television to just have a bit of space, a little bit of space where a character, where you're just on a character and you're having that character tell a story. There's a nervousness about it. And fortunately, we managed to, I think, hopefully stay true to that.
It's a gorgeous scene.
Yeah, it was, I was there on set when it was being filmed and I cried. I did a lot of crying. I did a lot of crying on the show. Every time I had to write episode 8, I cried all the way through, and my boyfriend would come in and be like, wow, still, Francesca. Still weeping. So what happened? What happened? And I'm like, no, it's still just
I mean, but I cried watching it, and I've read the book I don't know how many times. But that ending is a killer. That ending is just a killer, you know. It just, oh, heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, that episode, after episode 7 was such a giant challenge. I mean, it was really fun too. How do you get characters to, what does it look like for them to go and confront this sort of godlike authority angel who can see into their minds? What does it mean? I'm really interested in Jungian archetypes, and I think I had to think about some quite, and I had some such fun conversations with particularly Ruth about if Ruth was coming face to face with this extraordinary power, the kind of psychological dance that they would do around each other, what waging war with a being as powerful as that would look like. And for me, it would be psychological warfare rather than anything else. And so that was a really fun challenge. But then episode 8, such a different tone. And that script just, because the material is so rich and so perfect, it just fell out, that script whole. And it really didn't, there was very little that changed about it. It stayed the same, which is, and particularly if you know anything about this show, about the process of this show, that's really extraordinary, because the scripts change a lot, probably more than any other show that I've ever worked on during production. So episode 8 was a special one for me. It has retained its form. I'm really glad that it moved you.
Oh my God, like so much crying. You have no idea. So much. But let me talk about episode 7 for a moment first, because I'm just fascinated by your take on Mrs. Coulter and Lord Asriel. But we talked to both James and Ruth, and they're both fascinating on their characters, but they're so complicated people. They are such complicated characters, particularly her. And I mean, look, you've worked on Medici, you've worked on Succession. It's not like you're unfamiliar with very, very complicated people, but even by those standards, these two feel...
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So dense. There's so much to unpack there. And in particular for him, to go from essentially despising and being jealous of Lyra to that moment at the end of the episode.
Yes. What's so rewarding about writing characters as complex as this is that they allow enough space, because they are so complex, they allow enough space for everybody who's involved in crafting the story around them to put a bit of their own spin on them, you know. So they allow space for a myriad of interpretation, and that means that what you get on screen, hopefully, as a product, is something fascinating and with lots of dimensions. But it also means that part of the process is this wonderful, rewarding and challenging endless conversations that we have in the creative team. And it's been one of the great pleasures of the show, actually, being able to really explore that. I think Mrs. Coulter, for me, I find her one of the most brilliant characters ever to write and to interpret. You know, this sort of chilling archetype of the bad mother. I found it so enjoyable digging into what it must have taken for her to become powerful in that cold, masculine world of the magisterium. And I think one of the things that I find really interesting is that she has this instinct, born of her own past trauma, I think, to protect children from darkness. But that instinct is perverted, has been perverted. You know, in setting up that whole scheme where children were being severed from their demons, it's sort of, there's a motivation there at trying to keep them young and innocent forever. But by sort of protecting them, in inverted commas, you're actually stunting them. You're doing this awful violence to them. And I think that's a really interesting parable, I suppose.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but that does make a huge amount of sense. And it also, I think, explains so much of her fascinating relationship with her own demon, which, you know, again, we talked to Ruth about last season, but I mean, they are so deeply dysfunctional for most of, you know, the three seasons of this show. And there's a sense of, I don't know if it's reconciliation or some kind of rapprochement, at least towards the end, that feels like, you know, that there's been genuine progress for her.
Yes. Well, I think that is necessary. It was, we are unpicking it. Knowing that our end point is getting Mrs. Coulter to a point where she is able to fully see who Lyra is and make that sacrifice of her own life for her. That's a wonderful place to know that we have to, and same with Azrael. It's a wonderful place. You can sort of, you then do a reverse engineer of what are the steps that it takes to get her to that point. And it's, she has to learn that true love isn't possession. She can't drug her daughter into compliance. For me, it was all wrapped up in this idea of flipping the Adam and Eve myth that, you know, what if actually Eve choosing the apple of experience was not only necessary for humankind, it was actually the best possible thing, because living a rich, full life means experiencing darkness as well as light. And that means letting go of shame. I think that her shame is Mrs. Coulter's shame is demonstrated in her relationship with her demon. She lets go of her shame. There's a conversation that she has with Serafina that I wrote in episode 6, I think, where Serafina says, don't you see how experience, you are a monster, and don't you see that what experience has done for you? It's made you able to love, and you love your daughter. And I think that realization allows her to find peace with herself, and that's presented with her by her relationship with the monkey. And only then is she able to, because she's come into sort of full self-actualization, only then is she able to hoodwink this complex, all-seeing being.
And I mean, I love that it's sort of ultimately like accepting this weakness that she sees in herself makes her stronger, that she is able to, you know, use, yes, all her guile and all her wits and all her cunning and everything, but also her sort of newfound compassion in that moment. It's a fantastic, fantastic way of approaching it.
I think it's a statement about living in a world of such fundamentalist patriarchy that she has had to twist herself into this seductress role. I loved bringing her to a point where Metatron could see her. She was trying to do that same trick that works so well on the, you know, sexually repressed magisterium lot. But I love that I got to explore her to the point where she tries to use that trick on Metatron, and Metatron calls her out on it. And it's like peeling back the layers, that conversation that she and Metatron has, it's sort of peeling back the layers of the games, the tricks that she uses to manipulate. It's such a joy, this text, because it just allows so much exploration.
As you say, it's just so rich. It's just glorious. Well, what about Azrael then, though, as well? Because I feel like he is, he's He's so expanded here, first of all, from the book in a way that I think the show benefits from, you know, because he disappears for such long time in the book, and there's so little explanation of how he gets to where he ends up. But also just seeing him interact a little bit more with Mrs. Coulter and seeing that relationship, I thought was fascinating.
Yes. Well, it's sort of a love triangle in a way. It's a sort of funny parental child love triangle, really. I think that Azrael yearns for Mrs. Coulter's love, actually. Both Azrael and Mrs. Coulter find it very hard to love because love means it means vulnerability. Love means a letting go. And Azrael is so puffed up with a sense of his own importance for such a long time. You know, he's this egocentric, arrogant character. Again, how do you take him to a point of humility and sacrifice? And I loved the sort of process of breaking him down and seeing how really, you know, I think Mrs. Coulter is yearning for Lyra's love. And when we first meet Lyra, she's yearning for Azrael's love. So there's a sort of, they're all sort of wanting something of each other. And I know it seems a contradiction, the idea that Azrael sort of might love Lyra, but I think he's a little bit like the aversion that Mrs. Coulter has with her monkey, with her demon, to the vulnerable part of herself. I think Azrael has the same thing. I think he can't admit to himself that he loves Lyra, because to do that would make him vulnerable, and he need to do what he wants to do for his ambition to succeed. He needs to forget, he needs to ignore that part of himself. It was quite fun coming up with the idea of the form that Metatron takes to appear to Azrael. The idea
I was about to ask, yeah.
Yeah. Well, originally I just thought, how, this is a psychological battle. So what would Azrael most fear? What would be most challenging for Azrael? And I think to see himself, to face himself in combat would be, I thought that was a fun way of showing Azrael's psychology.
Yeah. He does have, I think, as you just said, like just essentially nuclear level arrogance, like just on a whole other scale. So
yeah.
Who else would he consider a threat, really?
Exactly. And I think he wants to, the contrast between the game that goes on between Mrs. Coulter and Metatron and this physical fight that goes on between Azrael and Metatron, it's meant to demonstrate the very different characters that Azrael and Mrs. Coulter are. I mean, I love the fact that they both come to realize that it's not about them, that it's about, and in fact, maybe their whole lives were not about them, but about this dynamic, extraordinary, explosive love that they had, creating Lyra, who's going to save the multiverse.
And also that moment of complete accord between them and their demons, I thought,
yes.
At the end, you know, having Stelmaria sort of ride in on a white horse at the last minute, just, you know, everything finally comes together in a way that they could never have agreed on anything before.
Absolutely. What I hope is you'll get as an audience watching this, what I hope is that we keep you guessing all the way up till the very end if Mrs. Coulter is going to, she's offered temptation on this extraordinary scale. She's offered, in the books it's more of a sort of seduction, but it seemed that the Mrs. Coulter that we'd developed, you know, with Ruth bringing all sorts of extraordinary complexity to her, it seemed like a fitting end is one where she is offered, the temptation that she's offered is sort of a supernatural status. I mean, that is true to the books too. I think Metatron does offer her a place as his sort of queen, but we kind of removed the sort of romantic relationship that is suggested in the book between Metatron and Mrs. Coulter, and instead it's power that she's being offered.
Which makes a lot of sense from everything we've seen of her, really, from the beginning of the show, that it's power that keeps her safe, isn't it? It's power that will protect her. So that's what she's always been after, yeah.
Absolutely.
And then let's then talk about episode 8 again, and just getting back to Mary and the Malefa. You I'm sure are possibly quite glad that you didn't have the challenge of trying to design them. I mean, they turned out absolutely glorious, but
yes. Oh my gosh, the team, Joel and the team and Russell. I mean, they're just so brilliant. The whole lot of them, that's just so brilliant. We were all a bit worried about how we were going to, I mean, I think, and Jane says it too, I'm sure she has said it to you, that she was worried about the Malefa. And actually, you know, the puppeteers are so fabulous too on this show. And Simone, who plays Mary, you know, she was so into it. She was so into it. And there was this beautiful relationship that developed, you know, between her and the puppeteers and the production designers, and the land of the Malefa being this Eden. It was amazing to visit on set, actually, because they really built that huge tree with the roots, like ginormous tree. And so you'd walk onto set, and it was, the scale was amazing. It really felt like being in Malefa world. It was quite extraordinary. Yeah, it was amazing. One of the things that I wish we'd had a bit more space for is to spend more time with the Malefa, honestly, because that's one of my favourite things about the books too. And particularly with Atal, I think there's so much humour in the book. Playfulness. There's just such playfulness. And I wrote a lot of scenes that unfortunately had to be cut. And alas, you know, everyone was sad about that. But hopefully what remains gives the suggestion and honours the nuance of the relationship between Mary and the Malefa.
That she, you know, she's the one who kind of pushes Mary into full honesty and sort of describing that almost Proustian scene, isn't it? Of you know, having a marzipan and having this whole flood of memory.
It absolutely is the Madeleine moment. I think Mary's such a great character for exploring the idea of the superiority that we have as human beings. Science as a sort of authority over us. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really loved about season two was the opportunity to bring in the idea of negative capability, which is what Lyra and Mary Malone discuss when they first meet, which is this idea of, it's an idea from Keats. I think the definition is the ability to perceive and recognize truths beyond the reach of facts or reason. And that, to me, is such a beautiful idea, and one that Mary comes to realise organically by being in the world of the Malefa. You know, that there are truths and experiences beyond the rational have meaning. And I just love that message throughout all three of the books, actually.
It's they're very, you know, humanist books. I mean, I think there was, you know, I don't know if there'll be any blowback to the BBC showing A War on Heaven at Christmas. I would hope that we've kind of moved past that now that these books have been thoroughly discussed out. But there's so much warmth and humanity and compassion in them that they, you know, I feel like even a lot of religious people, we actually had Father Richard Cole on the show in season one, but even, you know, people who are in theory being attacked in the books actually have a lot of time for them.
Well, I don't think that they're anti-religious, actually. For me, they're anti-fundamentalist. They're anti-authoritarian. What they celebrate is experience, is the complexity of human and beyond the experience. And that's the sort of the overarching message for me is that. I think that if you have faith, I think actually they're a beautiful book for you. It heartens me that you had Father Richard Cole on in the first season. That's great. It's good. I certainly don't see them as attacking any religion.
I think he pretty much agrees with exactly what you just said. So, you know, I think that's right. But I think that's probably a lovely place to wrap it up. But just one final question. You know, there are the prequel sequel books, obviously, that Philip Pullman is still working on. You know, if we're back here in a few years for The Secret Commonwealth, will you be fighting for a place in that writer's non-room as well?
I mean, listen, it's a gift to adapt Philip's work. I begged my way onto this show to begin with. I wasn't meant to be writing on it. And I was visiting Bad Wolf for another show, and I bumped into a big armoured bear, and I was so struck because I realised what it was that was being made. And so I basically begged to be involved. So yes, if they'll have me.
They'd be foolish not to at this point, because, you know, you're now on another one of the best shows in the world on Succession as well, which is just an astonishing show. If anybody listening hasn't seen it, correct that now. Unless you're a small young person, in which case maybe wait a few years. There's quite a lot of bad language. But Francesca, thanks so much for talking to us. And yeah, fingers crossed for the secret Commonwealth.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
I think one thing before we move on to the Land of the Dead to also just chat about is that scene with Mrs. Coulter and her demon. I thought this was really, really beautifully done. Some like superb writing here. And again, as always, just the visual effects work is fantastic on her monkey. And just to be able to to take us from a place where he was very much creepy and scary and in season one, and now he's very sympathetic. I particularly like that whole idea of, you know, I thought I was the strong one, but it was you all along, and that little touching of the paw. I loved it.
I thought that was great. And like we said, we've been talking about this, particularly this season, but even before, that her monkey is carrying so much of her buried trauma and her difficulties and her, you know, I think very cold, very lonely, very harsh childhood. And she's almost been blaming him for that and blame, you know, he's the repository of all that pain. And so to sort of spin it around this way, I thought was great. Getting them back on the same page feels like really important character growth for her. It just feels like that's an opening up of her character and an opening up of her soul that we never really saw until maybe the, I guess, the last moments of last series. But really, it's all been kind of growing since she had to care for Lyra 24/7 for months, you know?
Exactly. And as much as Lyra is the protagonist of the show, I think Mrs. Coulter is just the most interesting
fascinating character.
So yeah. Interesting. Okay, so Land of the Dead.
So the Land of the Dead, yeah. There was a lot going on this week. Like, it felt like, okay, last week we knew what they were going to try and do. They were going to try and climb up, find a place where the knife would cut a hole, and release everybody. And I think it's a little bit of a slow build to get to that point this episode, because you literally wake up in the immediate aftermath of that divine explosion. We wake up with Roger as our focus. He's kind of searching around for Lyra, gets her on her feet, gets everybody back on their feet, and they start marching upwards. And it's that same void that exists in Azrael's world that exists in every world. So that was kind of nice. There's a little bit of kind of squaring off, I suppose, between Roger and Will, but it felt weirdly friendly.
It also didn't really amount to anything. I actually not sure what the reason to include that was, because I feel like if you're going to introduce a conflict, then it needs some form of a resolution. But I guess it's just a sort of an incidental sort of. I mean, it felt real. I think that's how those two characters probably would react to that situation, a little bit unsure of this new person who has a pre-existing relationship with this person who you are forming a relationship with. I think it's all did feel very honest, but yeah, I mean, it's just like, it didn't really amount to much.
But I think the more important conversations in the Land of the Dead, you know, take place with other people. So there's a bit more business with the Harpy, but I think that Harpy that we saw last episode, who was kind of, you know, we don't have names, we don't do names, you know, and sort of flying away in a huff at the idea of being asked, almost kind of comes back, gets a name, and gets to hear these stories. And it's almost like this is all in the book, but I love this idea of the stories as an important thing, as something that can be used against the Harpies and used for the Harpies as well, to kind of soften their hearts and bring them some kind of relief from this awful place.
Yeah, and I like how it's again Lyra using words and storytelling as a tool to further her own ends, but also as a currency here. She's using it to exchange power, like it's transactional.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think again, it's leaning into her strengths and explaining why she's the hero of this and not Azrael, I suppose, isn't it? And then we also get the big emotional satisfaction of this episode, right? We get, you know, Lee Scoresby said he was running off to get stragglers at the back. You have to suspect that, no, he was actually running off with a slightly more specific target in mind. Don't you?
Because hang tight there,
Will, and I will come back with your dad, because I thought that was just such an important moment and in the whole show, in the whole story.
It's a nice reunion, and it's a very, very relatable feeling, I think, that a lot of, you know, who doesn't have that loved one? I think a lot of people would have a loved one who, you know, you just want it, would love to have one more conversation with. And I think, so they tap into the emotion of that very well. And, you know, Will finally gets to hear all the things he wanted to hear, because their last conversation was A, very fleeting, but B, very, very much about prophecies and things, and you gotta go. Whereas, you know, this, I think Andrew Scott or John Parry tells him that he, and he's proud of him, but that, and also, like, I like this acknowledgement of the failure that Will is feeling, or the regret for not having achieved this mission. You know, he's finally has his father's sort of blessing that he's more than he expected, right? Or he says, you're so much more than that.
Yeah, I think that was really important, because that's been his big kind of the thing that's been kind of tearing him in two, is on one hand, yes, I'm definitely going to find Lyra. That's my priority. I have to go and find Lyra. And then, okay, she wants to go to the land of the dead, so we're going to the land of the dead. But hanging over him all that time has been, yes, but my dad told me I needed to get this to Azrael, and I really also want to do what my long lost dad told me right before he died in my arms. You know, so it's yeah. kind of like, it's a lot to deal with, and it's something that I think would eventually have kind of torn him apart a little bit. So to have that sort of, well, okay, yes, I said that, but I didn't have all this information at that point,
yeah,
kind
exactly.
of moment was actually really, really important for them.
He's like, sorry, I got distracted by the side quests, Dad, and I haven't I haven't done the main mission yet. And then, yeah, then it all ends with Will finally, now that I think his mind is focused and he's had his, you know, he's got his dad's approval, which is all any of us want.
Yes, exactly.
He finally opens the gate, you know, the knife is working again. He's into, I think this is the Malefa's world, right? I think there's an implication.
Oh, maybe so. It just looked to me very sunny and pleasant and pastoral. I didn't see the tree, the giant trees. That doesn't mean they weren't there, because I've only seen this episode once. But yeah, I think the main idea is it is freedom, it is light, it is potential for the future. And it made perfect sense to me that Roger would be the first out, that he would be, you know, that he would escape, that Lyra would complete her mission before she does anything else. And there's obviously a sadness to it, that sort of the dissolve of the person Roger was, but also it's such a beautiful effect and such a beautiful moment that it kind of does feel like a return to the universe, a return to having potential. And
it was like the Thanos snap, but reversed.
It was, yeah, it kind of was. Like, it's a good thing,
like
not a bad thing.
It was a good thing. Yeah.
And if dust makes up the consciousness of everything, you know, it's kind of getting into slightly airy-fairy hippie ideas of, oh, we're all stardust, you know, which we are. But at the same time, like, it's not terribly helpful as a concept most of the time, but like it kind of plays into that idea of, yeah, you return to the universe, you remain part of everything. And I thought that was a really nice way of playing it.
I like that. I it is a very common spiritual idea, but it's one that is a lot more appealing than never-ending purgatory in Land of the Dead. So I could see it as a massive relief.
Absolutely. And seeing all those characters who we have been basically chasing for the last 2.5 books go through and be released and find some kind of peace. You know, seeing Lee name check his demon before he went, I thought was lovely.
Yeah, so we've closed off the Land of the Dead.
Or opened up the Land of the Dead.
Oh,
yeah.
Very, very good. And we are now in the last two episodes. The big confrontation feels like we're getting there. Things are coming to a head. Chasms are opening.
We're in the end game now. I think,
that's
just
it.
To quote another series. But but I think, yeah, very much things are moving back together, moving into place. You know, characters who have been separated for half a season or more are kind of beginning to come together and find one another. Once again, it really feels like everything is building towards something pretty epic as a conclusion.
Yeah, right. Well, see you for episode 7.
See you then. Can't wait.
is Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our producer and editor is Maddie Searle. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. Our executive producers are Kobe Amanaka and Tom Wally. Our hosts are Helen O'Hara and myself, Dave Corkery. A big thank you to Ian Johnson at IJPR, to Bad Wolf at the BBC, and to all our guests for taking the time to chat to us. If you want to chat to us, you can do it at producers@stripped.media.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.